The rest of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Anna Wilcox.
And I'm Josh Salem. All of our KBOO programs, including the evening news, are supported by our members. If you would like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for KBOO's News in Depth.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. I'm Althea Billings. I'm joined by Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, to talk about his latest article for the paper. It's called, If Troops Arrive in Portland, Will They Sweep Homeless Encampments Like in D.C.? Welcome to the show, Jeremiah.
Hi, Althea. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you for being here. So this new article of yours, it's asking a big question, maybe the question after the question a lot of people have been asking, which is, will troops be deployed to Portland? But looking at that follow-up, what will they do once they get here? This is what you were focusing on. So in other deployments in American cities over the summer, this troop deployment has meant sweeping homeless people. Talk to me a little bit about what D.C. and L.A. experienced when troops came there.
Yes, as the president has continued to send the military into these cities, he's used a couple of different parts of the U.S. code to do that. The one in D.C. was specifically, in his words, was to get rid of all of the crime around the city, and he sort of conflated crime and homelessness. These all came after these other executive orders. And he invoked Title III for that deployment. Here in Portland and in LA, those are a little bit more similar to each other than to Washington, D.C. deployment, in that he invoked Title X, which essentially sending them here to defend federal property. It's a bit different because it's related to protests over immigration enforcement that have been happening at the ICE facility. It was a very similar thing in Los Angeles where they were defending the ICE facility there and also did a few other things there. But in Washington, D.C., it was a different part of the U.S. code, and National Guard troops actually did go out and sweep homeless encampments, clean up parks. People probably saw videos and photos of National Guard members sometimes standing around in parks with not much to do, likely because the president had really inflated, his messages about crime in the city.
I want to talk about that rhetoric for a moment of conflating crime with homelessness. Of course, Trump has been saying that Portland is war-torn, is war-ravaged, that it's burning down, that crime is running rampant, even though our crime statistics have been going down, so has D.C. Where do you think that kind of rhetoric comes from?
Well, I would, argue through the reporting that I've done on homelessness over the years that there has been a pretty bipartisan effort to criminalize homelessness for years, and there's a real misunderstanding with legislators who are, both kind of constructing and responding to community narratives about homelessness that really place a lot of blame on people for the position that they're in. And much of the time people are in that position thanks to the failure of those very same leaders. So there is a real effort, the Grants Pass v. Johnson case at the Supreme Court last year that came out of Oregon, sort of said it's not cruel and unusual punishment to punish homeless people. And those narratives, as housing costs soar through the roof and people are less and less able to afford their housing, it leads them into homelessness. And then the same government that put them in that position in the first place ends up going and punishing them. So there's real broad sort of strange consensus around this that makes it very easily for President Trump to sort of invoke these narratives and have, you know, people either sort of tacitly or very directly agree with him.
What was the experience like for homeless D.C. residents?
I talked to Jesse Rabinowitz from the National Homelessness Law Center at the time in August when the D.C. Metropolitan Police Department was federalized by President Trump. And, you know, there were traffic stops all over the city. People couldn't get through to restaurants. For homeless people, they did expand some shelter capacity by about, you know, 100 beds. But when you have 800 people there with nowhere to go and insufficient shelter space, you know, it still really didn't meet the need. So in general, you know, Rabinowitz told me that people were just terrified. They were being moved around. A lot of people were lost, and they were no longer had contact with service providers who they may see on a regular basis, people who come to them to provide services and help them with entering housing. And yeah, it was just sounds like a really terrifying experience for people.
How did the National Guard interact with homeless folks in LA? Was that part of their focus?
I didn't find any evidence that they were helping to sweep people, and that may be, you know, kind of good news for people here in Portland, because those are very similar situations. There, again, it was to protect federal buildings and personnel. Something that's worth watching out for here in Portland, and I'm sure the Rapid Response Networks will be paying close attention, is whether or not National Guard members will be assisting ICE in immigration enforcement. Our local police, state police, due to the sanctuary law, are not allowed to help ICE agents, but it depends on the interpretation for the National Guard here in what they actually can do. And if assisting in immigration enforcement, if they interpret that as, you know, protecting federal personnel while they're on immigration raids.
Yeah, what do we know about the stated plans of the National Guard's deployment in Portland? Is it clear what they would be wanting to do here?
So it all gets a little bit shaky in here because these things are changing by the minute. And currently, there's a temporary restraining order through the court. There's also, you know, it's the Oregon National Guard on, I think, Thursday, and then it was by Saturday, the California National Guard was coming here to get around a court order. And then by Sunday, we're hearing that, you know, Texas National Guard are coming to Portland. And so it can be really hard to find out exactly where we're at in this moment. But I have to give a ton of credit to a lot of, you know, daily news outlets that are covering this stuff like to the minute. It's really, really important coverage. We're in a little bit of a different position with a 1 week print deadline. We sort of zoom out a little bit differently, but, you know, all credit to people like yourself that are doing this moment to moment. That's a long, circuitous way to get to the fact that the Brigadier General of the Oregon National Guard said on the 29th that he was specifically, the mission here was specifically for the National Guard to protect the federal facilities and protect the federal employees that are working in those facilities. It doesn't necessarily mean that Trump won't just do whatever he wants, but again, there are legal consequences for those things, maybe in the long run, hopefully in the long run, if people are breaking those directives.
I mean, that aiding in ICE enforcement is part of what brought about court interaction stopping things in L.A. Am I right about that?
Yeah, that is true. That is part of the Northern District of California's was, you know, in that court order saying that, you know, this is a pretty severe overreach. Something that was, again, parroted by the Oregon Judge Immergut in that temporary restraining order that basically, you know, having a standing army, this is on the verge of martial law and is not something that is necessary or needed or even helpful.
For this article, you also spoke with Tung Yin, a professor at Lewis and Clark Law School, about some of the nitty-gritty of the law here and where it may apply to Portland in different ways than in other situations of deployment like DC and in LA. What are some of like the big things from your conversation with him?
Part of the way that we got into, you know, telling this story is that you first hear of National Guard troops in Washington, D.C., and you see that they're sweeping people, sweeping homeless people. And, you know, for our audience and our organization, you know, it's really important to highlight those things when they happen here and elsewhere. And, you know, one important thing is that basically Washington, D.C. is, you know, it's a creature of federal law. So there, Trump invoked the Home Rule Act and Title III to bring the Metropolitan Police Department under his control. But here, instead, he's invoking Title X, much more related to like protest activity. There are very specific things the president, you know, has the authority to do. And it's a more of a takeover of a state National Guard, which, according to these judges so far who have seen the facts on the ground, does not seem to be the kind of circumstances that would require a military presence here in the city. But the fact that Washington, D.C. is a sort of under federal control in a very different way than states are, this becomes a very significant states' rights issue, something that Republicans and Republican Supreme Court have always been pretty big fans of.
What do you hope folks take away from this story?
Well, I think it's important always to spread facts and not fear. And while there seems to be very little risk that the National Guard would be coming out and assisting, you know, Portland police or, you know, the outreach workers from the city on homeless sweeps of homeless encampments, you know, the risk isn't zero. So it's worth, as ever, keeping an eye out, the same way that we've been hearing from rapid response networks to keep an eye out for ICE activity, the same thing with homeless Portlanders who might be, you know, at risk of being swept by the military. There's really not evidence of that. I think it's fine to sort of like dispel a myth a little bit, but it is still worth keeping an eye out, you know, for our neighbors who are not living inside.
If folks at home want to read this for themselves, what's the best way for them to do that?
The best way to get Street Roots is to buy a copy from a vendor. They're in your neighborhood and they accept cash, Venmo, and tips. And you can also find us at streetroots.org.
Any final thoughts before we wrap up?
Yes, actually, thanks so much. For the past 2 years, we've been having these conversations on the radio, and I really appreciate all of the work and that you and the people at KBOO do. This is going to be my last. I'll be leaving Street Roots at the end of next week before your next News in Depth. And I just, I'll still be around in the local media ecosystem, more to come on that. But thank you so much for all the work that you do, and thanks to everyone at KBOO.
Thank you, Jeremiah. We really have loved having you as a regular on the program.
I'll come back.
Okay, good. That was Jeremiah Hayden, reporter at Street Roots, speaking with me about his latest article. It's called, If Troops Arrive in Portland, Will They Sweep Homeless Encampments Like in D.C.? Experts say Trump's National Guard deployment in the U.S. Capitol had different legal implications than in Portland. The risk of military sweeps of homeless encampments is low, but not zero. More information is online at streetroots.org. For KBOO News in Depth, I'm Althea Billings.
KBOO News in Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
You are listening to KBOO News in Depth. At the Portland City Council Housing and Homelessness Committee meeting on Tuesday, councilors revitalized a proposal to ban AI rental price fixing. The proposal was passed to the full council on a vote of 3-1. Here are some excerpts from that meeting.
Susie Doister, Councilor Murillo's policy advisor, here to present, as Councilor Murillo said, a little bit on the updates that we've made to this ordinance and just a little primer again on why we're here, what we're trying to accomplish. So the most generic and straightforward academic definition of price fixing is anti-competitive agreement among competitors to raise, lower, maintain, or stabilize pricing. So it's often assumed that we're talking solely about raising of rents, but we're also talking about lowering, maintaining, stabilizing. It's about moving in concert, competitive predators that are working as collaborators. This is something that's been illegal for over 100 years at the federal level. Of course, the Sherman Antitrust Act, the Federal Trade Commission Act, some of which you may be familiar with. It's also prohibited under Oregon law. So this is something we talked about during our last session, this idea that because state law also prohibits the same thing as federal antitrust law and gives the right of entities and individuals to affect their rights under both state and federal law, this question of, you know, will this lead to a deluge of lawsuits if we codify these items at the local level? It's kind of a moot point because state law already empowers people to act in service of advancing their antitrust rights. Next slide, please. So again, why are we here? So we're talking about a long established principle against competitors acting as collaborators. What is the problem? So we have a modern iteration of price fixing, algorithmic price fixing, the hub and spoke model. So how does that work? It's essentially the same concept of the old style price fixing, but again, done through an algorithm. So we have a service provider that serves as the hub of the hub and spoke model. It collects data. It then uses that data to train algorithmic models. Those models then recommend rent prices, occupancy levels, lease terms to, again, competitor landlords. Essentially the equivalent of gathering these landlords in a digital conference room to get them to collude on items like rent pricing, occupancy levels, et cetera. That model then enables participants to collude, align prices across changing market conditions, again, increasing, decreasing, stabilizing, holding units vacant to keep prices high, something that is an especially important consideration if you're in the midst of a housing crisis, as many cities happen to be. So the final stage of this is that participants profit at the expense of tenants, small landlords that don't want to undercut their competition. They want to act in a free, open marketplace, and local businesses as well. They're harmed by this as well because businesses can't earn the money of tenants that are forced to pay inflated rent prices. So next slide, please. Is this even a problem? This is something we're asked with some frequency. Why does this matter? Why are we talking about this now? Well, a White House analysis in 2024 found that algorithmic price fixing cost tenants an extra $3.8 billion in 2023. This is across a number of cities. So it's an average of $70 extra paid per month. But cities like Atlanta, where we saw a high concentration of service providers that act as that hub, you'll see an extra $181 per month. So a pretty substantial increase. There have been empirical studies on this matter, one cited on this slide above by Calder Wang and Kim. So finding again that markets with high algorithm adoption saw significantly higher rents than markets with few adopters. Also significant is those high adoption markets saw units being held back. So lower occupancy, higher vacancies, units being held back for higher prices in order to profit. But okay, we don't care about other cities. Why do we care? Is this a Portland problem? Well, as we discussed previously, two of the three largest landlords in Portland are named defendants in the antitrust lawsuits filed by the Department of Justice against RealPage. RealPage, of course, being the largest actor in the price-fixing marketplace, controlling over 80% of the market, last I looked. So these two landlords collectively manage over 32,000 units in Portland, representing approximately 10% of the city's total housing stock. So that is just two landlords. Additionally, five of the seven defendants in the DOJ lawsuits against RealPage operate in Portland. So it's not limited to these two landlords alone. And then, of course, if that's not enough, DOJ's supplementary economic analysis that they used to substantiate their main claim against RealPage specifically mentioned Portland as a marketplace in which agreements between landlords and agreements between landlords and service providers, again, like RealPage, have resulted in harm to renters. So that's coming from the Department of Justice. So let's just talk a little bit then about what we've done to change this ordinance. So why update? So we had some time. We were obviously working extensively on budget and other matters, and we wanted to use that time to explore the landscape, see what other cities are doing, and look at how these experiences can help clarify how we can maximize impact with our draft and legal durability. So the amended draft reflects a lot of those lessons learned. So focusing on coordinating conduct, not particular technology, and this is something we'll talk through in greater detail, and also ensuring clarity in what is not covered by the ordinance. So just little tweaks. The core is the same. And just in this vein, so Seattle's bill drafted in a remarkably similar manner to the one before you today, passed without controversy. So these lessons learned are translating into a more comprehensible, acceptable product. The first change that I'm just going to talk through briefly, and I think it's the most important change, is just a simplified structure, recognizing that this is an exceptionally complex bill, probably one of the most complex bills that we'll encounter, and trying to streamline it to the greatest extent possible, but also focusing on a key distinction. Again, we're focusing on the same conduct, but we want to be really clear about what we're regulating and why. So instead of focusing on the tool, which is what we did in the previous draft, what goes into the tool, what comes out of the tool, how are you using the tool being the focus of the ordinance, we're focusing on the behavior. So again, what we've talked about this entire time, we're being very clear that we are addressing the coordinated behavior between landlords and the service provider, the hub and spoke conspiracy. We are not regulating every instance of a tool. I think also very important, but again, not as important as the first one, but certainly up there, we're clarifying the scope. As a general matter, I think that these exemptions are better as they clarify what we are not regulating. So what does not constitute price fixing? So being very, very clear that conducting appraisals, feasibility studies, collecting or analyzing certain types of data in service of doing what is essentially market analysis. This is all great. These types of analyses contribute to the pricing efficiencies that we hear so much about. These price setting tools create efficiencies of sort, but only for the people who are participating in this collusion scheme. Efficiency for whom, right? So any landlord can continue to use a tool under this ordinance with their own data. And they can continue using market research, they can continue setting prices and capitalizing on any efficiencies that are derived from that. That's not what we're talking about here. If you look at exception 5, collecting, analyzing, or communicating public data without referencing non-public data, or otherwise coordinating decision-making about dwelling units between different beneficial owners. Again, the chief ill that we're regulating here is coordinating between different owners. You can't coordinate with yourself. So if you want to have market research, you want to do your own research with your own algorithm, with your own data, that's wonderful.
Good afternoon, counselors. I think Chair Avalos, if she's still online, hello, Vice Chair Dunphy. For the record, my name is Chris Olson. I'm a resident of District 2 and I'm a member of the Portland Democratic Socialists of America Housing Working Group. It's a mouthful, we'll figure it out. I want to, just first of all, thank Councilor Murillo and Kuyana Lane and Green for bringing this ordinance back after a brief but necessary delay. The DSA has heard from thousands of renters across Portland through primarily door-to-door canvassing and tabling at major events in the area. And the message that we hear every single time is just the rent is too high. Portland has become an unaffordable city for the working class. And these are the people that make the city run. Teachers, service workers, artists, caregivers, and young families, the people that we want to attract to the city. The use of profit-maximizing algorithms only deepens this crisis. These programs are not neutral tools. They are designed to coordinate rent hikes across the market, pushing prices upward and squeezing tenants out. Renters deserve fair and transparent pricing based on real market conditions and not automated systems optimized to extract every dollar of disposable income. An affordable housing market depends on real competition and public accountability, not secretive corporate software. Right now, our economy heavily favors these large landlords and property investment firms who treat housing as a commodity to be hoarded rather than a human necessity. And as rents rise, working people are forced to spend half or more of their income just to keep a roof over their head. Every dollar that goes to rent is not spent on our local economy, on groceries from neighborhood markets, meals at small restaurants, childcare, and other essential services. When rent consumes the majority of household income, it starves every other part of our city's economy. High housing costs are not just a housing problem, but they are a barrier to economic growth in this city. And they suppress consumer spending and reduce entrepreneurship and make it harder for local businesses to survive. In short, housing costs are the single most significant drag on Portland's broader economic viability. And Portland's affordability crisis doesn't just hurt renters, it weakens our entire city. And in the case of the housing emergency that we've had, I've been reviewing since the past few days that we had declared in 2020, 2014, that the situation has gotten 7 times worse. We declared a housing emergency when there were about 1,500 people at the point in day count. Now there's over 7,000. So clearly, this is not an issue of just mental health or drug addiction. This is a housing issue, a pricing issue that rent has become so affordable. Bottom line is Portland has become our home and we have the right to live here and thrive here. Algorithmic rent setting software is not a harmless business tool. It's a mechanism to displace a displacement that accelerates inequality and hollows out our communities. Without intervention, we risk following the path of cities like San Francisco and Seattle, which they have put this ordinance in place, which is fantastic, that working class people though are normally priced out of these neighborhoods. So I appreciate your willingness to pass this ordinance and we urge you to vote yes.
Members of the Homelessness and Housing Committee, my name is Joseph Gardner. I'm testifying today as a lifelong renter and on behalf of RealPage. Counselors, we're back and I'm once again here to respond to false allegations about my client, accusations that have never been borne out in a court of law and which in many cases appear to originate from a Department of Justice criminal investigation that was withdrawn without charges by the Biden administration almost a year ago. To set the record straight, RealPage does not engage in price fixing. The authors of this proposal, confronting that pesky reality, are again trying to redefine what the term price fixing means to fit their preemptive judgment. In so doing, they've written a ban that is so broad that it would prohibit a nearly endless range of widely practiced market analysis techniques and basic computer activities. You've already heard from numerous experts in previous hearings warning about the serious unintended consequences that would arise from this proposal, including driving up the cost of rental housing in Portland and chilling desperately needed investment into new residences in the city. You've heard that this latest draft addresses those concerns, but sadly, the new language does not fix this ordinance's fundamental flaws. The new version, for example, supposedly allows the use of public data, but the poorly worded caveats and sweeping qualifiers included in that exemption still place unconstitutional restrictions on analysis of publicly available information. Similarly, the bill's ban on all private data, its ban on historical data in perpetuity, and the creative new ban on hypothetical anticipated future data that doesn't even exist yet, all create restrictions that far exceed the government's narrowly tailored interest in protecting market competition. That issue is why savvier jurisdictions tend to narrowly restrict their bans. For example, forbidding the use of public competitor data or only banning historical data less than 90 days old. In its current form, this ordinance would not survive a court challenge. But Portland cannot afford the reputational loss from a prolonged court case and headlines saying that our city has unlawfully violated the rights of housing providers. The City Council has made positive strides in recent months trying to remove some of the onerous obstacles that have strangled investment and residential construction in Portland for years. If passed, this ordinance would wipe out all that recent good work.
Council Maria, you have your hand up first.
I guess I have some reflections on what was said here today, particularly from some of the corporations or from the lobbyists of corporations that are here representing their clients, particularly RealPage and others who have conducted some of the most egregious price fixing that we've seen. So I want to start off by saying that this amended proposal was worked on extensively with city attorneys, and we have made a lot of adjustments to the language. We took feedback, and it was made clearer. Our original ordinance never banned Excel, but I see that we are still using that same tagline, which I think smells of desperation, frankly. But I also want to say that the criticisms that we are seeing, that this will enable any random person to file a lawsuit against their landlord, we live in America, one of the most intense litigation-heavy countries in the world. Anyone can file a lawsuit against their landlord right now for any reason. That is part of people's rights. So this doesn't change the fact that people can do that right now. That's the status quo. I have also supported things like the SDC waiver to ensure that we can build more homes in the state of Oregon and particularly in Portland. So I do support home building. And I do think that we need that right now because we do have a shortage. But I also want to say that I'm not sure that some of our critics on this policy will ever be content with this policy, because like most corporate actors, there were criticisms that this was too specific when it was brought to the state legislature and too prescriptive, and that it is too broad here. The prior criticisms were also that it banned specific tools instead of behaviors, and now we heard that they're concerned that it bans behaviors instead of specific tools. So there is a constant shift in the arguments that are being used against this policy that I don't think are being, if they're being brought in good faith, they are certainly not consistent, and that does not allow us to create meaningful policy. So I think people have to choose. Is this a do-nothing proposal, since price fixing is already illegal, or is this a boogeyman that is going to upend all housing in Oregon? I just, you know, you gotta pick one. And I would say that it's neither. I would say that this proposal protects renters, which is what it's meant to do, especially when we live in a time where most people, especially as someone who was raised by a single mother, my mother could never afford to raise her two daughters in this city again.
Will the clerk please call the roll?
Dunphy?
Aye.
Ryan?
No.
Murillo?
Aye.
Avalos?
Aye.
With three ayes, the motion carries, and the ordinance document number 2025-045, as amended, will move to full council with a recommendation to pass.
You've been listening to KBOO News In Depth. I'm Althea Billings. Thanks for being with us.
Demento, I am here in a land of happy, freaky people. KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of